Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
This is December 1st, 2020.
December 1st.
And, we're on episode 128 of Transmission.
And, you know, we only have one more month of 2020 to go.
I'm worried, like, you know how everyone's like, oh, here's a meme. This is if 2020 were a pie and someone, like, sprays shaving cream into his hubcap, like these sorts of like memes going around. I'm just worried that we haven't been really preparing ourselves for the real shit show that is 2021. Because you know, yeah. I'm ever the pessimist.
You're ever the optimist. Well, good morning, folks, and good morning from Connecticut. It's great. Good morning from Missouri. As you saw on the screen, brilliantly orchestrated by Mark, today is one of the more annoying days of the year, Giving Tuesday.
It's right up there with Pledge Drive on NPR.
Absolutely. Which is a whole week, so that's actually way worse. But
and usually you can kind of just like ignore your emails, but if you're driving and you want to be listening to Kai Rizdahl talk about marketplace, you're stuck. Like, oh no, hey, Kai's dude, asking us for money. I just wanted to know what the Dow Jones Industrial Average was doing.
That's right. So, because it's Giving Tuesday, we're going to jump on the bandwagon because our fundraising has been so successful to date. Yeah. So we're just going to keep going on that and say that, yeah, if you feel like this has been helpful to you and you've got a little spare change to send our way, we would greatly appreciate that. And you can do that at the MICA website, at the CPI website. There's a link at the Transmission Facebook page. That'd be wonderful.
And just, you know, I'm assuming a lot of you know what we do when not doing this, but maybe just briefly. the Center for Prophetic Imagination, we do things like spiritual direction. And one of the things that MICA, which is Dan's organization, ours, we're launching a spiritual direction program that's focusing on social transformation. You can find that out about that on the CPI page, which is propheticimagination.org. And we do workshops and educational things. And MICA's work is somewhat similar, but they have some of their own different things going too. So maybe you could say a little bit about that, Dan.
Yeah, and we've also got a link to the Spiritual Direction Program on the MICA website. And we do work in spiritual life and leadership, healing, and the arts. And so that's looked different during the pandemic, right? No in-person retreats, but we've done a lot of great educational things online, and we'll have more coming up. And as I said, we'd appreciate your support, and we really love the in-person support a lot more, right? I really love all our commenters, and we've got really a great community of a very, very thoughtful, provocative, loving, intelligent folks that make Transmission what it is. So, with that said, yesterday we had a great conversation about codependence and the codependent culture. And, you know, one of the nice things, I actually view this as a nice thing, even though it's a challenge about this being only half an hour, is that, you know, by the end of the half hour, we always have a ton of great more stuff to talk about. So it doesn't get boring. You know, we're not like 90 minutes in sort of slogging away going, oh my gosh, what are we going to talk about now? And so yesterday we were talking about this issue of codependence in our culture and how, you know, so much of the way that we are set up is that there's very little accountability or boundaries around unhealthy behavior. And so we got a great comment from Catherine Parent, Dr. Parent, who often supplies wonderful comments and is actually the board president of CPI. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, okay, so in the right wing world, one of the big logics, one of the arguments around making abortion illegal is, you know, we want to make people suffer the consequences of having sex. Mm-hmm. And, you know, is that what you're talking about when you talk about not being codependent?
Yeah, and talking about karmic sorts of ways of thinking.
Right.
Well, that logic applies to, I mean, that's how meritocracy works. Like, right. If you're poor, stop whining. It's your own damn fault.
Right. Yeah, and so because that came in towards the end, and we said a couple things about it, but I really felt the more I thought about it during the day and this morning that we really need to return to that, because I think that that was such an important observation about the way this logic gets used and twisted that it would be kind of worth a whole episode. So I thought up a fun little example, a kind of a jumping off point example that's sort of silly, but I think indicates how we really have so few examples of a non-oppressive way of relating to one another. So my example is, let's say I find out that Mark likes getting up every morning and starting a fire in his living room on the floor.
How did you know?
I just, you know, a lot of spiritual practice. So I'm psychic about that kind of stuff. And so I find out about this and I'm very distressed because I don't want Mark to get hurt or for the house to burn down. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, my initial response is to come running over there every morning, even though I don't really want to, I'm busy. And, say, Mark, don't make a fire and bring a fire extinguisher and put it out. And, you know, but every morning Mark keeps making a fire in his house. Right. And so that's the classic codependent relationship. So I'm being codependent. I'm trying to, you know, protect Mark from the fire. I'm trying to do all this stuff. And, you know, it's not doing any good. He's still making a fire in the living room every morning. So then the other approach is to say, okay, fine. Mark's going to make a fire in the living room every morning. So I am going to go over there. And I'm going to board up all his doors and windows and, to sort of protect the world from this fire. And now Mark makes a fire. The house catches on fire. He tries to escape, but the house is boarded up and he burns to death and dies.
This took a dark turn.
Yes. And then I say, well, see, it's his own damn fault. You know, if he just hadn't started a fire, he wouldn't have died. Except that's not true at all, right? I decide to act in a coercive manner because I thought what he was doing was bad and wrong. And the reason he died was because I boarded the house up, right? And that's the way that a lot of these coercive approaches to this issue really are working, right? Is that we don't pay attention to the coercive, oppressive aspect of it. And then we blame people for the situation that they've been put in by the coercion. Right now, the non-coercive thing would be to say, look, Mark, I really care about you. I hope you don't die in the fire. This isn't a great idea, but, you know, if you're going to make a fire, there's nothing I can really do about that. Now, then when the fire starts burning the house down, you know, you could run out, you could try to put it out yourself, you could do, you know, whatever happened, what's going to happen. But there was a freedom for you to respond and to deal with that situation. You know, you could call the fire department, whatever. Right? And so I think that we're so immersed in this codependent thing that it is actually hard for us to imagine what a healthy, bounded, non-coercive world would even look like.
I think about it all the times that sort of, I mean, you're going to have to deal with the consequences of your own action is not usually, even in a healthy relationship, the way you necessarily, that's not the rhetoric you hear all the time. What you hear that most of the time, like Catherine pointed out, from these folks, like when Kyle Rittenhouse killed some people at protests that were related to the movement for Black Lives, and people saw, well, what did they expect? That's right. The consequences for their actions. That's where it's usually heard and employed. And there's all sorts of things that, you know, if you take a step back, the reason that that logic works for them, even though it's, if you analyze it at all, you realize it's not true. Or when someone drives into a protest that is blocking the interstate, well, what did they expect? The only way it makes sense to think about things that way is if you don't understand any power dynamics existing in the world at all. And that if you think punitive actions are a natural consequence.
Right.
Now, if you're anywhere left of center, the further left you go, the more you start thinking, well, punitive actions aren't exactly a consequence. That's a form of coercion, unless it's kind of revolutionary violence upward. We can have all kinds of conversations about that. But that's not or let's think about the way people get Malthusian. And I'm using that term. Malthusianism is this idea that humanity is a scourge in itself. We're like a virus upon the world. And lacks any analysis that, you know what? Someone in White Earth Reservation isn't the same as Jeff Bezos. So why are you lumping them in together when saying they're both a scourge? The consequences, the regular people deal with the consequences for environmental degradation that is disproportionately caused by wealthy people and big industries. And so the earth being destroyed is not exactly a natural consequence for our actions. It's more of a consequence for someone else's actions. And one of the things that power allows them to do is push the consequences onto other people. So all of a sudden you start realizing, like, you know, this the way that they use this rhetoric of consequences is warped by an inability to see how power functions and scapegoating and all these kinds of nasty things that they do. And so maybe the language of consequences for actions has a charge to it. But underneath it, if we think about it, you know, it really has to do with setting boundaries and saying, I'm not going to put myself into the position of being responsible ultimately for you, because that's not something that I can really do.
Well, yeah. And then, you know, and we can even take it back a deeper step in terms of this kind of power analysis and say, okay, so if you're raised in a patriarchal family structure, if you're raised in a toxic religious structure, where God is this ultimate evil patriarch, the psychotic warlord, as I like to refer to that image. Everything about consequences, you know, really is formed in our mind to be about violent punishment. Right?
Yes.
Right. Everything about consequences is about violent punishment. I do something bad, I get violently punished. You know, the people of Israel do something bad, God, you know, violently punishes them. You know, you do something bad, wait till your dad gets home. You know, he's going to beat you. I mean,
when you were 12, you masturbated for the first time. God was watching. The wages of sin is death, and therefore your right punishment is eternal torment in hell.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is actually the logic.
Right, right.
And then if you say, well, no, that's not as big a deal. It's not like it's murder or something. And they say, well, all sin is equal. There's all these sorts of weird, twisted ways to justify every punitive and nasty thing that ever befalls a human being.
Yeah. And so, you know, so that's also very powerful in terms of getting the codependent guilt thing going, because it's like, oh my gosh, you know, if every consequence is violent punishment, well, of course I want to keep the people that I care about from getting that. So of course I'm going to do all that, you know, all that effort to prevent that from happening over and over and over again. Right. And so this is where, as I say, I think that just a super important starting point from this is to recognize that formation, like that in our, you know, we talk a lot about imagination in this, you know, Center for Prophetic Imagination. In our imagination, you know, can we even understand a reality in which consequence and violent punishment are not linked? Right. Can we even imagine that? Like, because until we can imagine something like that, I think we keep getting tripped up and caught by that. Because it's so prevalent. And so many of us, you know, have been raised in that, right? I mean, that's how we were formed one way or another, whether it's an abusive family, abusive religion, abusive community, you know, whatever it might be. And so there's this just immediate kind of neural knee-jerk reaction in that direction.
Comments are starting to come in, but I want to share just a short little autobiographical kind of story, just a short one. So for years I did hospitality ministry, like in the Catholic worker style. And so often would get guests coming in. And to me, that act of doing hospitality is like, some people would even see that as enabling to begin with, which I didn't, that at the base level is not. Giving someone a place to stay is not necessarily in and of itself enabling. But what would happen is over time, I would start doing this thing like, well, I have a home and I don't deserve it more than them. So how could I ever turn them away? Already in that logic is not me thinking about what I need for my own healthy flourishing or the analysis of their situation. And so over time, when someone would come, they'd come in drunk, which again, by itself, doesn't have to be enabling to let some drunk person sleep something off. But there, a pattern would emerge where people could always come and do whatever they want and take out of my life, energy, money to sustain themselves. And at a certain point, I had to realize that I was becoming unwell personally by doing that. So when you don't have any way of thinking about, like, and, you know, I did the things where I talk to them and try to help them, connect them with resources. But at a certain point, it's not wrong to say, I can't do more than this. Mm-hmm. And this idea that I need to do more of it to the point of my own lack of health was totally tied up in my way of understanding Christianity and having this idea that, well, Jesus didn't set boundaries, like things like that kind of thinking. Right. Now, so let's go to the comments, because I think these comments are going to dig up some of the stuff underneath that, my story a little bit more. But Catherine writes, this was historically also a big conservative rhetoric for ignoring the early AIDS epidemic by framing it as consequences for gay sex, which led to a ton of unnecessary suffering and death of people who deserve support, research, and medical care.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's a great example. And Deborah and I were actually in medical school in San Francisco when AIDS was discovered. And so we, you know, we saw this unfolding in real time. I mean, we would have professors come in and give these lectures of like, okay, so down the street in San Francisco General Hospital, there are all these people pouring in with this weird illness, and we don't know what the hell is going on, and they're dying, and this is bad. And right, and what you saw following that immediately coming from Reagan and, you know, his whole crew, was all this language of like, okay, we're not going to do anything for these folks because they're gay. And again, it was this direct model of consequences not only means terrible punishment, but it also means that we are going to coercively participate with what we are seeing as natural punishment, right? So that's the other part of it. And that's where, you know, my example of I'm going to come and board up the house, right? It's not just bad enough that, you know, the house is going to maybe burn down, but now I'm going to participate in that consequence by even more negativity and coercion, right? Well, again, that's not allowing somebody to experience the results of that karma. That's actually adding coercive, abusive negativity to what is already a difficult situation, right? And, you know, in the name of my own self-righteousness, of which there was a huge amount flying around during the AIDS pandemic, which, by the way, is still going on. There's still an AIDS pandemic.
Leah writes, also possible that if you had a real relationship with Mark, maybe you could find out that he starts the fire because he's cold. I think sometimes the coercive or codependent acts come not from not knowing why people don't live like you think they should without understanding motivation. I mean, I've seen this a lot of times. Like, if you judge people judging motivations and then therefore getting punitive about it.
Right. Yeah, no, I think, Leah, that's a great example, is that so much of what the dependent-codependent dynamic covers up or avoids is the possibility for real relationship, right? And so, you know, in the classic original way that this was talked about, right, in the alcoholic family, I mean, what people were not doing was sitting down and really talking about how much pain they were in, right? How much pain the alcoholism was causing, how much pain the alcoholic was in. There wasn't real relationship going on. And so you're absolutely right that underlying this particular type of unhealthy relationship is that lack of deeper real relationship.
Series writes, we live in a culture that enables abusers. We often don't put pressure on abusers to change.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, Series just launched her Patreon yesterday, which looks really cool. And so I would encourage you to check that out. And Series, if you want to throw up a link to that in the comments, please feel free to do so. Excited to see and hear how that evolves and your stories and writing and things.
I mean, this is interesting. Like, this codependent thing can tie into all sorts of directions. But one, when you mentioned abusers not having consequences, to me, it's hard not to start thinking about this sort of pushback to cancel culture. Right? Now, can cancel culture become toxic? Well, yes. But at the same time, if the first in the first news cycle of someone being found out of saying something transphobic or something, the first you start saying, well, but J.K. Rowling's books are so important to me, or one of the big theologians within my world, John Howard Yoder, when it found people started realizing more and more, they're like, well, we can't just get rid of his books because he's too important. Like, that sort of way of first, that's where it starts getting very codependent sounding, as though some person is such a unique contribution to the world that the idea of sidelining them is seen as a bigger threat than them continuing their abusive behavior. Again, this is an example of like, it's a, that just restrains a clear transparency about what they're doing. It's kind of putting it to the side. But instead, by doing that, J.K. Rowling, for example, because I don't think her finances have been hurt at all. There's nothing to, she doesn't have to deal with the pain of her words. Not really. So this could pick on J.K. Rowling a little bit.
Well, and but what this does point out also is, and this is one of the things about the sort of punishment dynamic, especially the eternal punishment dynamic, is that it really is this incredible binary all or nothing, right? And so it's like, you know, so for example, if you have a powerful person in the community and you find out they've, you know, done these horrible things, and you're like, well, I don't want them to have power in the community. And people are like, well, we can't, you know, get rid of this person, right? They're beloved and extra.
And you're like, talking about murdering them.
Right. Those are the only two options. It's just that we don't want them to be in charge anymore and have power. I mean, if they want to hang out and sit in the back and reflect upon their ways, and that's great, right? But But we have this very binary view, and that's another one of the things that keeps us trapped in these codependent situations.
And so let's just look at the Magnificat. This is Advent, so this is the time of year when people start paying attention more to that passage, and others like it. That's an example of the way that they saw judgment was the rich being torn from their thrones, not the rich being shackled and like tortured to death, torn from their thrones. And so there's this reversal. If these people in power who are abusing their power need to be brought low while the low are brought up, that is a type of judgment. So that's yeah. judgment in a way that's restorative and allows for the possibility of repentance. So even with the rich young man, the so-called rich young ruler, there was a call to repentance. The call to repentance doesn't really quite make sense without an understanding of judgment. But the problem is judgment doesn't have to look, it's not punitive. Judgment doesn't have to be punitive. What it does mean is they realize the consequences of what they bring into the world and are made to look at it deeply and given a choice to change or not. And if they don't, there is the hope, and there's a hope in divine judgment in the sense of them being brought low. That sounds still, a lot of people hear that, that sounds harsh and mean sounding, but to me that's like, there's so much hope and restoration in that. Yeah. And if the alternative is just to be eternally codependent, I don't know if that's a much better choice either. Gus writes, I think another part of this codependency and consequences, we should also talk about harm reduction as a model.
Right. Yeah, which is, I think, a lot of what you were just referring to, right? That if consequences and judgment and repentance are about reducing harm as opposed to punishing, well, that's a much more uplifted view.
Well, within the context with Gus works with people who are without houses, unhoused peoples. And some of my work, particularly in the past, is in that community. And there's often experiences of drug abuse and drug addiction and other things. And so oftentimes people would talk about them experiencing the consequences of their actions. It's just like letting them freeze to death outside. Well, they're high. Like, no. And so part of why the way I'm hearing Gus bring up harm reduction is like, look, it isn't codependent to do the base level of human decency to make sure that they have things available to them to keep from dying. So having like needle exchange spots, things like that, that minimize harm. This is always brought up, like when you're doing needle exchanges, it's like, well, that's encouraging them to keep doing drugs. Well, I don't think so. It is encouraging them not to do dirty drugs. And so it gets very an interesting kind of discernment question of like, when you alleviate the suffering caused by someone's own actions, at what point does it become codependent? At what point is it just common human decency?
Well, and one really great sort of marker and kind of red flag to all this is that when the only time you're talking about people experiencing consequences is yes. when it's the most abused, oppressed people in society.
Yes.
You're probably on the wrong track. Like, and you're not talking about Jeff Bezos experiencing consequences.
Elon Musk.
You've probably sort of missed something somewhere.
This is why talking about this stuff without a deeper analysis does become very thorny and problematic, as Catherine has pointed out, and it's right to caution us, but at the same time, we don't want to remove an understanding of judgment and restoration from these kind of conversations. Ceres writes, so we are gaslighted to believe that demanding ethical treatment and care is equal to punishment. I'm trying to think about that, and I'm wondering if you can unpack that a little bit more.
Yeah.
So I feel like there's something in there that I'm missing, so if you have time, please do so. Kathleen writes, interesting discussion for me since I'm preparing to adopt a 3-year-old shelter dog with quote unquote issues. Setting boundaries and using positive reinforcement are priorities for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, it may seem a little trivial compared to some of the things we're talking about, but dog training is actually a great example of this. Like the new, you know, the sort of in thing now in dog training is that people have finally realized that, oh, positive reinforcement is better than shouting no at your dog and whacking them. And to me, the fact that it's sort of taken this long for people to figure that out and to become more mainstream. I mean, I'm sure other people have done it, but now it's really mainstream. You know, is a great little cultural example of what we're talking about. Well, I could say more, but I'm looking at the time.
Yeah, so. We're past time, as yeah. is our way. Catherine writes, curious to know how many white Christian anti-maskers are acting from the rhetoric that sin leads to disease as punishment. Thus, they are protected from COVID by Jesus dying for their sins. Mm-hmm. The not living in fear anti-mask argument seems like a reference to this theology. I mean, my sense is, like, I wouldn't say it's a majority, but I think it's a lot. Like, especially people in the Pentecostal stream of things. I know some Pentecostals, some of whom are not as far gone as others, but it's prevalent. Like, Jesus will protect me if I have faith.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've definitely seen people talk about this very directly, Catherine. Yeah. You know, Jesus died for me. I'm protected. My house is protected. No mass this Thanksgiving. You know, yeah, absolutely. Just sad, crazy stuff.
Yeah. I can, you know, it's interesting thing that things that are unseen fall into this category, but things like economics, which is also to me just as mysterious as vaccines, is like, well, if they blew all their money on a bad investment choice and they suffered for it, they'd be like, well, consequences for my action. Jesus didn't protect me from that. So it's interesting where mystical kind of woo kind of thought, mystical in the bad sense, I use the word mystical in a good sense more often, but that sort of woo kind of thinking applies only to specific situations that somehow lines up with their way of wanting to see the world. Scott writes, wasn't feeling God talk at all this morning, but actually really needed to hear this reminder about codependency and coercion. Thanks.
You're welcome.
This is Patreon link. It's patreon.com/ the prophetic muse. So just look up the prophetic muse on Patreon if you can't remember this link. Kathleen writes, I am declaring my independence from Christmas culture this year. I'm not mad or depressed. I just don't need it. Well, we could go out. Maybe we should talk about consumerism and Christmas sometime. Scott writes, Howard Wass's response to Yoder was so bad for just that reason. The instinct to defend the theology without interrogating its connections to what John Howard Yoder actually taught about nonviolence. For those who aren't
in power, Wass has issues.
There's all kinds of stuff, but basically, Yoder was sexually coercive and abusive and harassing of people. And for someone who talks about nonviolence and power, that's significant. It's not that he was there's ways that you can really fuck up that might not have a lot directly to do with your work, and then sometimes it's more direct. And this is one of those direct things. And so, people trying to defend John Howard Yoder, who, to be honest, influenced me a lot and probably still influences me in his thinking. So it's not like I'm saying everything he ever did was toxic and needs to be destroyed forever. But if we can't have an ominous conversation about these problems without apologists coming forth and saying, no, don't be so hasty. Let's focus on the good more than the bad right now. That's just toxic ways of talking about things. And when people are dealing with the pain of abuse. Scott writes, without interrogating the abuser's connection to the theology. Ed writes, like that line of thought, nationalize and democratize animism. Amen. And if not nationalize and democratize, like maybe find a way to like legally force them. I would love it if they could just be forced into turning into a co-op. I would settle for that. Yeah. Gus writes, no one is like, hey, I wasn't going to do heroin, but now that you gave me a needle, why not? You're still going to have the consequences of the heroin use, but you won't get Hep C as a bonus. That's right.
Yeah,
exactly. Again, that's the punitive thing. Like the idea that somehow like they should just get every kind of disease and die because that's the consequences of their actions. It's like, no, we can have some mercy and humanity in this.
Well, plus, they're not on an island in space by themselves, right? Actually preventing them from getting hepatitis C decreases medical costs, decreases other kinds of costs for society, makes that person more likely sometime down the line to be able to get other kinds of help. I mean, it's a win-win for everybody. And again, that's the harm reduction idea as opposed to the punishment idea, right? They still have the consequences of doing heroin, right? I mean, but society recognizes that there's other simple ways of being helpful all the way around that are good.
This is also made problematic by the operating assumption in our society, which is most things that take care of you as a human being are not your right. Right. So having a conversation about consequences for actions is different in the United States than if we were in a country where healthcare, housing, and food were provided. And the assumption was you could fuck up all you want, but you're not going to get that taken away from you because those are rights. Here it's like if you let that person even like sleep inside of a structure anywhere, you're just enabling them. Like, oh my God. Because we have such an anemic, impoverished moral culture. Ed is very magnanimous. Give Bezos a couple of bucks on his way out. That is very merciful.
Yes.
Catherine writes, this is a great conversation. Digging into the power dynamics and unpacking the different forms of consequences rhetoric is really rich and helpful. Thank you.
Well, thank you for inspiring us.
Ceres writes, enabled abusers and their enablers often gaslight us when we demand ethics and ethical treatment of ourselves and others. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Faith, is good to see you commenting here, Faith. I'm glad you're listening in. I went to seminary with Faith, and Faith also grew up down the road from where my wife grew up. So we live in a small world.
Whoa.
Scott, right. I wrote on Barth and Yoder for my PhD. So I get it.
All right. Wink.
I said Karl Barth first because that's how it's pronounced, but then it's one of those things that if you're not a theologian, you always say Barth. And so I'm just saying it both ways. It's like Kierkegaard and Kierkegaard. Saying things if you're a nerd. I think that was our final comment.
That was it. Great.
Less than 40 minutes. It's almost like 30 minutes.
All right. Well, thank you all. It was great to be with you, see you, hear you.
Yeah. And we'll
throw a few bucks our way.
We'll see you tomorrow.
And see you tomorrow. Bye.